From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Go Pats!
The New England Patriots have their victory parade in Boston. We'll check in on the celebration. And over in hockey, big changes for the Bruins. Head coach Claude Julien gets fired.
I apologize that it fell on a day where obviously New England is incredibly excited.
Also today, why is the state legislature considering 15 new bills that could radically change the marijuana legalization law that voters passed last November? Plus, a wide-ranging conversation with Martha Minow, outgoing dean of the Harvard Law School, including life lessons she picked up from Justice Thurgood Marshall.
He had nicknames for everyone, and they weren't always complimentary.
And yours was.
Oh, Shorty. I had many. Shorty, girl. And if one of us bristled, he said, just get used to it. You're going to be called worse when you get out there.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it is winter in New England, so of course Mother Nature offered up her own sparkling white confetti as Boston celebrated the Patriots' Super Bowl victory today. Hundreds of thousands of fans lined the parade route in a bit of snow from Heinz Convention Center all the way to City Hall Plaza. Dylan Joseph from Quabbin was one of them.
I came here because they won their fifth Super Bowl, and that's not common, you know, like my father didn't see any Patriots Super Bowls, but now that I've been growing up, I've seen five. You know, you got to come out with support. The greatest of all time, Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, it is what it is.
It is what it is. And even a normally monotone Bill Belichick got the crowd fired up.
Let me tell you, these players, they've worked harder than any team I've ever coached. They came to work every day, and there were no days off. 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 Go Pats!
No days off. Look, it takes hard work to be a victor. WBUR Steve Brown was also there. He was riding on the press truck, and he joins us now from Beacon Hill. Hi there, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Meghna. Yeah, you know, Bill Belichick, you know, I was standing right below Bill Belichick when he was saying that, and he was actually smiling when he said that. It was a big grin on his face. It was something to see.
Absolutely. Look, just yesterday on the show, we talked all about how the mental toughness of the Patriots, you know, is what really pulled them through on Sunday night's game. And quite frankly, it takes no days off to have that kind of mental toughness. But I understand that today, during the parade, you were right in between some of the players. So tell me, what was the mood like? What were they saying? What were they doing?
Well, if you want to hear a lot of people cheering and screaming and yelling, ride in the press truck between Tom Brady's duck boat and Rob Gronkowski's flatbed. And my ears are still ringing after that trip down Boylston Street and Tremont Street and Cambridge Street. You could really tell that the players were really soaking it all in. You mentioned the snow confetti that mixed in with real confetti, red, white, and blue, showering down from the sky. Really kind of made it neat to look up, and you'd get snow on your face and confetti in your face. It was amazing. Rob Gronkowski, you know, he was injured most of the season. He didn't play in the Super Bowl, but he is still a big fan favorite. He was in the truck right behind us, and you could just tell as the parade kept going down, he was getting more and more into it. At first, he had on a shirt and a hat, you know, one of those woolen hats with a little pom pom on top, and I noticed that we were making the turn from Boylston Street onto Tremont Fairmont Street. People were tossing up to him, well, let's say they were cans of soda, maybe. and so he would open it with his mouth and chug it and then throw it back. By the time we made it down to the corner of Cambridge Street and New Chardon Street, he had his shirt off. He was leading. You know, it was something to see. He really definitely put on a show. You could tell, you know, the thing of no days off. They were under a lot of pressure for a long time, all season long. They, you know, the coach Belichick keeps them under a tight rein, and now they've been partying pretty much nonstop since after that football game in Houston two nights ago.
You know, if there's any time that a paroxysm of Boston joy has been deserved, this is it. So, you know, enjoy it while we can. I mean, what was the crowd like? I'm seeing that, for example, just on the Boston Public Library, there was a big Pats logo and a sign that said "Best Story Ever." Anything else fun you saw in the crowd? Oh.
Lot of signs, lot of Roger that signs. You'd think Roger Staubach was the different Roger, I guess they're talking about. But needless to say, a little vindication, little payback, little, you know, hey, we got you. There are a lot of signs that and some chants that we can't quite repeat on the radio that Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, was the subject of. The fans just very, very happy, as you can well imagine. And, you know, it was a nail biter there for a while. So they were letting off a lot of steam today.
Well, that's WBUR Steve Brown giving us an update on today's Patriots victory parade held in Boston. Steve, thanks so much. I hope you get your hearing back sometime soon, too.
Okay, and time for parade number six.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of no days off, no days off, no days off, I want to bring in Boston Herald sports columnist Steve Buckley and not give him a day off because he was lucky enough to be at Houston for the Super Bowl itself. And he joins us now on Radio Boston. Steve, it's great to have you.
Sleep is overrated.
So has it sunk in yet? You've had a couple of days.
No, it actually hasn't. And, you know, as a columnist, my job is to sometimes be critical, be funny, or try to be something. But it's okay to take a step back and marvel at the history of what you've just seen. And as someone who saw the ball go between Bill Buckner's legs in 86 and so forth, I've seen the agony, and to be able to write about the history, the good history, which is like the Sox in 04 and what happened Sunday in Houston, is something you get to keep for a while. It's pretty cool.
Absolutely. And I have to say, what I do love about this, there's lots to love about what happened, but the story of perseverance really is it's gonna become absolutely part of Boston lore, not just sports lore, but I think Boston lore. Now, but the question is, what about the future here? Because there was chanting today of "We want six," as Steve Brown mentioned at the parade. Tom Brady even joined in. And just yesterday, a host on SiriusXM NFL Radio, in fact, asked the QB about retirement. Here's what Brady said.
If it was up to my wife, she would have me retire today. She told me that last night three times.
Okay.
And I said, too bad, babe. You know, yeah. I'm having too much fun right now.
So, Steve, Tom Brady's clearly in it for at least another year, if not more. What do you see in the immediate future for the Pats?
The easy answer is the building blocks are in place. They've got the two key components. The only common thread for all five Super Bowl championships, outside of ownership, of course, is Bill Belichick, the coach, and Tom Brady, the quarterback. As long as they remain a tandem and as long as they remain on their game, so to speak, and clearly both of them are, there's really no need to pull back the reins. I mean, they go into the 2017 season as, if not the favorite, then a favorite to return to the Super Bowl and win the Super Bowl.
Yeah. You know, while I've got you, Steve, I want to switch gears really quickly here and talk about something that's happening in hockey. It's kind of like a Friday afternoon news dump, people hoping that we're not going to notice, but we did, because the Bruins have fired their coach, Claude Julien. And at a press conference this morning, Bruins general manager Don Sweeney addressed the criticism of their timing. He mentioned it straight away.
Well, sort of like the weather in New England, I did not necessarily pick this day to take away from a great accomplishment by the New England Patriots. But I had taken a few days to assess where we were at and came to my decision to make a change with regards to Claude.
Now, Steve, Julien has been with the Bruins for a decade, and he led the team to their sixth Stanley Cup. So why are they letting him go?
Well, because all coaches get fired eventually. I mean, 999 out of 1,000 get fired. There's the rare, stellar, iconic coach who gets to go out in his terms. He's not that. So the fact is that the Stanley Cup they won was back in 2011, which is a long time ago. And so you might say his time for a coach the last 10 years is pretty incredible. So when you get down to the nitty-gritty, they're a rebuilding team. They have a lot of young players. They really don't have the guns to compete for a Stanley Cup this season. And I think it's safe to say that he was probably scapegoated to a degree by moves made by upper management. I happen to think he was doing a pretty good job. But, again, coaches do get fired. The question is why they had to do it in the middle of the Patriots Super Bowl parade. That's the larger question.
Yeah. Well, Sweeney, again, talked more about the timing of the decision today and, in fact, how it might help the Bruins overall.
The timing became an opportunity for us to evaluate going down the stretch where these players are and how many of them can fit into what we want to do going forward. And the decisions they have to make accordingly, how the players react to a different voice.
So, Steve, while I've got you, let me ask you, that different voice, at least for the time being, is going to be assistant coach Bruce Cassidy. What do we know about him, and what do you make of him as a head coach now?
Well, I mean, he's been around the organization for quite a while, and he's had coaching experience. I just don't think that a coach – this isn't like a team that's on the cusp of vaulting to greatness where – there was rancor in the locker room or something going on, say a coach, general manager rift and so forth, and that a guy can come in and inspire everyone to take their game to a higher level and reach the common ground. This isn't that. This is a team that, no matter who the coach is going to struggle to at best make the playoffs. So the one thing he did say, which is something I think he may want to roll back on, Cassidy said, I want to be more aggressive in practice. That's what I like to do. And I don't think a more spirited, faster-paced practice is going to take the Bruins to a higher level. Mm. What he should have done is not even mention that. And if he wants to rev up the motors in practice, then do so and leave it for the media to say, hey, these guys seem to be revving it up in practice. And then he can say, oh, it's just something I like to do.
Yeah.
But it to me, kind of sounds like a criticism of the previous administration, if you will, and I don't think that was warranted.
Well, Steve Buckley is the sports columnist for the Boston Herald. Steve, thank you so much. It was great to talk with you.
My pleasure.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Martha Minow recently announced that she will step down as the dean of Harvard Law School at the end of this academic year. She began her tenure there in 2008 in the midst of the financial crisis. And in the intervening years, the law school faced serious questions about diversity and racism. And as Martha Minow ends her tenure this year, parts of the legal profession are feeling a new ripple of energy around the presidency of Donald Trump. So let's begin our conversation, though, by listening back to a clip of a 2015 commencement speech that Martha Minow gave at the University of Michigan.
What does it take to stand up against what is wrong? And when and how should we? We have a word for not standing up. The word is bystander. It means a person who is near but does not take part in what is happening. We don't have an obvious word for its opposite, but here's a new one, upstander.
Upstanders.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, thanks for taking a look at that. I actually, for much of my career, have been very interested in the relationship between law and justice. It's always intrigued me that we call these law schools instead of justice schools. And one of my goals as dean was to put on the table, where's justice? And my own research has looked very much at issues such as genocide and what does it take to prevent mass human rights violations. There are willing people who actually don't like what's going on, but are standing by. And that's the bystander problem. And actually, terrible things cannot happen if people actually refuse that role and instead stand up against injustice.
Did you grow up in the kind of family where being a bystander wasn't an option?
Correct. Absolutely. And I'm really proud and lucky that my family has been engaged in politics and in public life for more than one generation.
Well, let's be specific, right? Your mother, Josephine, she was a civic activist. Your father, Newton Minow, he was what, chair of the FCC?
He was.
Under President Kennedy?
He was. And both of them have remained very involved in civic life.
What was dinner table conversation like in the Minow family when you were younger?
I would say I didn't really realize until I was in law school that it was unusual to be expected to have views on the issues of the day. But we were expected to participate. As my parents would come with the topics they were working on and ask our views.
So your father was, he's widely credited as being one of the people who really founded modern public television, right? Were you asked to argue at the dinner table on behalf of why tax dollars should go to supporting public broadcasting or not?
Let's be clear. He's been a lifelong advocate of public radio as well. You know, although he's well known for calling television a vast wasteland, when he was involved both in the government and then in the private sector in improving television, he would sit the children down and ask our views of various shows on TV.
Wow. So what kind of, do you remember the type of shows that he asked you about?
Oh, sure. I mean, these were early yeah. children's television yeah. shows that were about science particularly.
And what was your verdict?
I think we didn't hold back.
A very lawyerly response, if I do say. Given that, that family environment that you grew up in, there actually could have been many avenues that you pursued. Was going into the legal profession always something that had called to you?
No, actually. I was going to do anything but law, and I really thought I'd be a journalist. And there was a moment in college, it was the Watergate era, and I was working in Washington. I had an internship with a congressman, and I thought the journalists were heroes, but I also thought I personally wanted to be more directly in the fray.
Uh-huh. So Watergate was the moment and that
yes.
helped you through. Interesting. Okay. And so then the fray was going to law school.
Well, it's true. It's also true that education reform has been at the core of my own professional work, even again going back to high school where I worked on education reform.
Yeah.
And I went to graduate school in education.
Oh, the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
Exactly.
Right.
And my goal was to work on, it was civil rights. It was the second year of Boston busing. And access to education for kids with disabilities. Those were my issues. And what I found was that lawyers were dominating all the discussions. Lawyers were in charge of framing what the policy debates were. And so I went to law school out of self-defense.
Huh. So, I mean, at that point in time, though, did you think it was a good or bad thing that lawyers were so dominating the discussion?
I had mixed views, but I felt pretty strongly it was a language that allowed people to be at the table, and I wanted that.
Okay, so you went to Yale Law School.
I did.
So when you wrapped up your time at Yale, did you know which direction you wanted to take your legal degree? Because as you said earlier, there's so many ways that one could go.
I had every expectation of going to be a civil rights lawyer.
Yeah.
I had the great opportunity to be a law clerk, including a law clerk to my lifelong hero, the person I admire so much, Justice Thurgood Marshall.
So tell me what it was like to clerk for Justice Marshall.
Clerking for Justice Marshall was an extraordinary opportunity because he, of course, is a world historic figure. He's also known for his storytelling. I mean, absolutely riveting raconteur who could play every role, who could play every part of the experiences that he had, some that were public and some that were much more quiet and private. But also, in addition, he was a really fantastic lawyer. And I learned a tremendous amount from him about how to analyze a case, about the relationship between procedure and substance, about who's a good oral advocate.
Now, what kind of relationship did Justice Marshall have with his clerks? Did he shower you with good advice or like? What was it?
So Justice curious. Marshall was a teaser. He had nicknames for everyone, and they weren't always complimentary.
And yours was?
Oh, Shorty. I had many. Shorty, girl, many topics like that. And if one of us bristled, he said, just get used to it. You're going to be called worse when you get out there. I'll never forget. I once wrote a memo on a particular case recommending a course of action. He threw it on my desk and he said, this is bleeding heart liberalism and it'll persuade nobody, including me. High standards. High standards.
Wow. Wow. What an experience that must have been. But since we're talking about Justice Marshall and about civil rights as a whole, let me just briefly ask you, for a while now, there has been sort of this meta-level criticism of Harvard Law School as not having diverse enough faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that as you look towards the end of your tenure
sure.
as dean.
So one of my aspirations as dean, since I had been such an advocate for increasing diversity of the faculty as a professor, was to do what I could on that score. Since I've been dean, in all of the job offers that we have made for faculty people, faculty posts, half of them have been to women. That's unprecedented. And we went from one African-American woman on the faculty to six since I've been dean. And that's just a tip of the iceberg. Many, many different kinds of diversity. Diversity along methodological lines. We have many more historians and people who use psychology. And many more people who are connected with other parts of the university, as well as several who actually were not born in the United States and studied law in other countries. So there's a way to go, but it's a much more diverse place than it was when I joined the faculty, I can say, in 1981.
You know, I know it's a great conversation when every answer that someone gives me makes me think about 15 additional questions. So I'm struggling here a little, which way to take this conversation. But let me get back to you and your career, because I think
Thanks.
That's maybe the part that many people don't know enough about. You actually spent some time working on Kosovo after.
That's true.
After the Kosovo War or during the war? I can't remember.
There was a wonderful justice then at the Constitutional Court of South Africa, Goldstone, who was appointed to head a commission on Kosovo.
Mm.
And he asked me to serve on it, which I did. And that certainly drew me into a very difficult legal question. Was the humanitarian intervention lawful? And if it was not lawful, was it justified?
Did engaging in that investigation, that work, in trying to answer those two questions, did that challenge what your view of the
yes.
intervention in the 90s? It did.
Absolutely.
How?
Absolutely. Because I was against the war. And I did conclude with the commission that it was unlawful, but I was persuaded that it was justified by the evidence that we had presented to us.
Unlawful but justified.
Yes, yes. So why? Because there were gross violations of human rights. It violated the steps that the international law at that time had in place. Since that time, in part because of our own commission report, international law seems to have changed.
Yeah.
And responding to imminent or mass atrocities that violate gross violations of human rights actually can justify the use of force if it's proportional. So that's pretty much where the commission came out, and I was persuaded despite where I came in.
Is this something that we're going to have to contend with again and again? Because it feels like in so many arenas, domestic, international law, the law does lag behind.
It does. It does. The law, I think for good reason, lags behind because there often are new developments that are dead ends, that are false, that are not productive. But law catches up. And this is one reason I've for so long been so interested in the relationship between law and other fields, other disciplines, because we lawyers have an expertise, but it's an expertise in resolving disputes, setting up frameworks, making sure that there's order and continuity. But what's the content of the
right.
rules? How should they change in light of technologies that the framers of the Constitution, for example, never could have imagined? We need to hear from people with knowledge outside the law.
Aha, which is why Harvard Law School is doing a lot of cross-disciplinary stuff now, right?
Bingo!
you set me up for that. I mean, so you're talking
Perfect.
About immigration, not just in terms of the
yes.
letter of the law, but its impact. needs of military veterans, things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just been an unbelievable privilege to help lead the school in building clinics in exactly these areas and to involve people from across the university and other places as well in our environmental work, for example, in our work on housing and after the foreclosure disaster. It is just a fact that any serious problem right now requires the contributions of more than one discipline.
I see this as a welcome change because the idea that that legal scholarship exists in a vacuum outside of the society in which it has its impact has never made sense to me. To me, the letter of the law is sort of the codified conversation that we have with each other about what is acceptable and what isn't in the societies that we want to build. So to have that conversation outside of the actual society never. It's quite computed.
It's a beautiful summary of what law is and should be. One of the reasons I'm so happy that our faculty has such a strong group of historians is that people like Annette Gordon-Reed and Tomiko Brown-Nakin and Bruce Mann and Sam Moyne help us make sense and understand how law has evolved over time. And one of the ways in which law connects to society is by reflecting on how law itself has changed.
So then what are your thoughts on those who subscribe to originalism, like our newest Supreme Court nominee?
Interpret the Constitution in light of the original what? Intention? Well, that we don't know what was in the minds of the framers, and the framers couldn't imagine television, much less virtual reality. Is it to come up with some kinds of rules so that we look only at the past? Well, that's not going to be responsive to changing circumstances. I do understand the worry is that judges who are appointed and aren't accountable to an electorate may be pursuing their own point of view and not responsive to anything else. But Justice Scalia was fond of saying, I know originalism is faulty, but show me a better alternative. I think there are better alternatives. I think understanding how law evolves case by case by case, the way we described, that is one of the ways that judges are restrained from making leaps.
Yeah, interesting. Well, since we are talking about the court again, the Supreme Court, let me ask you, if Judge Gorsuch is confirmed, we will continue to have a 9-member court where all of the members either went to Harvard or Yale law schools.
It's true, although as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is right to remind
us. Oh, her Columbia connection.
Yes,
right.
She was a student at Harvard Law School for 2 years, yeah. And she petitioned to spend her last year at Columbia while still retaining a Harvard degree so that she could be with her husband and her child. And the then dean said no. So her actual degree is from Columbia.
Okay, point taken. I stand corrected. But you see what I'm driving
yes,
at, because
I
this
do.
Has been a it, this is a significant issue that's worthy of conversation, and people have been talking about it, about whether or not a court that's peopled entirely by folks who come from a very small set of law schools can adequately represent or even take into account the diversity of interests, opinions, backgrounds from people across the country, different socioeconomic levels, things like that. And also on top of that, I would add, we got a lot of prosecutors or former prosecutors on the court.
And we don't have very many people who actually ran institutions. Elena Kagan's the only one who actually ran an institution in the
Your
private
predecessor.
Sector. That's correct. Yeah. My former student. Well, you look, I think that there are many factors that go into the selection and approval of Supreme Court justices or any judge. I think that there is, however, the proper pressure to find the very best. When President Nixon nominated unsuccessfully several candidates, one defended himself on the grounds that the mediocre deserve representation on the court. I don't think that's a compelling argument.
I'm going to push back on that, though. The idea that the best only come from Harvard, Yale, or Columbia.
I did not say that.
I think I hear people at Stanford Law School or UT Austin are like just.
I did not say that. And I have many of my former students are teaching at law schools all over the country, and I'm very proud of them and proud of the work that they do. I will say this, that it is a somewhat uninformed view to suggest that elite legal institutions like Harvard and Yale law schools are themselves insular and lacking diversity. Our students currently, 44% students of color, a large number first generation. We do our best to find talent in all corners of the world. And one of the great things about schools like ours and others, which would include Northwestern, Arizona, is that students come from different backgrounds and they learn how to talk with each other and learn how to grapple with the tough issues of the day. So I think that the kind of training that we offer prepares people for the job at stake.
Am I getting you fired up now?
No, I just want to say that having co-authored two amicus briefs in the Supreme Court defending the diversity and for affirmative action in our admission of to students, something I feel very strongly about, it's the character of our institution. So anyone who suggests that somehow these are not diverse places hasn't looked at them closely.
What about in terms of the justices having come from largely a prosecutorial background? Because it was some time ago I spoke with someone who said in his dream scenario, the next Supreme Court justice would be a public defender.
Well, I think there are all kinds of points of view that would be very helpful. I certainly think more experience with the criminal justice system, period, would be helpful. The fact of the matter is Justice Thurgood Marshall was the only one on the court, in my memory, who actually handled a death penalty case. And I think that that's an important, at least as a
handled one as in terms of being the lawyer representing
the lawyer,
the accused.
Being the lawyer defending the accused. I do think that if there's a concern, again, about the lack of diversity on the court, I would have some concern about how many have served in the executive branch of the government and therefore have that point of view, whether they are, I'm sure they all assiduously try to step outside of their past experiences, but it's hard to shake fully that point of view. Mm-hmm. In terms of geography, you know, I think Merrick Garland would have added to geographic diversity, and I'm sorry not to see him on the court.
One could say that Neil Gorsuch will, if he's confirmed, being from Colorado.
Yes, and liking to hike and fish.
And owning a ranch. So Dean Minow, let me ask you, I mean, we haven't touched on sort of some of the major controversies that engulfed Harvard Law School during your tenure, but we've discussed them more broadly. I mean, the law school moved to remove the family crest of the royal family from the symbol, the shield of Harvard Law School, in acknowledgement of the royals' slaveholding past. What was that like, having that conversation, that process going?
Sure. I'm really very proud of our community. We had a process that involved more than 1,000 people participating in the discussion to ultimately recommend to the university, because it was the university that had adopted the shield in 1936, that the shield be suspended. It was adopted without much attention to the history and what it meant as a symbol of the institution. And one reason I'm proud is that the report issued by the committee led by my colleague Bruce Mann is so learned and so thoughtful, and also produced an equally learned and thoughtful dissenting opinion. And when I read the report and forwarded it to the university, I thought, you know, I almost don't care what the university does now, although I endorse the majority recommendation, because this exemplifies what we stand for more than anything. Why was there a dissenting view authored by Annette Gordon-Reed and joined by a student? Because the view was we don't want to eliminate our history. We need to pay attention to our history. We need to make sure that every subsequent generation learns our history. And we are making as strong a commitment as we can to make this very process and the report and its dissent part of the introduction to Harvard Law School.
You're going to stay on as a faculty member.
Yes.
And your advice for whomever may take your place.
Oh, three pieces of advice initially that I can say publicly, and then there'd be much more to say privately. But the three pieces publicly are, first, it's amazing how much you can get done if you don't need to take the credit. The second is have a sense of humor and proportion. And the third is make sure that you are the person with the smallest ego in the room.
Wow, that's seems like a tall order for Harvard Law School, but Martha Minow is the dean of Harvard Law School. She'll be stepping down at the end of this academic year, but remaining on the HLS faculty. Dean Minow, it has been a real delight and pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
I'm such a fan. It's really a pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's been almost exactly 3 months since Massachusetts voted to legalize recreational marijuana in the state. And yet here we are. The market still hasn't been fully set up. Moreover, there are 15 new bills pending on Beacon Hill that could significantly change what voters thought they were approving back in November. Well, why is that? Joining us now with an answer is Senator Jason Lewis. He's the Senate co-sponsor of these new bills, and he's with us in the studio. Senator Lewis, it's great to have you back.
Thank you, Meghna. Good to be back with you.
Okay, so I want to give folks who don't know this the brief headline on what some of these bills would do. They propose to change the cap in terms of how much you can have at home of marijuana, change the home growing number from 12 plants to 6 plants, change how cities and towns could opt out of marijuana sales, and also there's things about the Cannabis Control Commission, about drug driving, et cetera. But let me just get straight to the question. Why do you have these 15 new bills which seek to change what voters passed with question 4 in November?
So as you rightly point out, on November 8th, the voters of Massachusetts voted to legalize recreational marijuana. And we are committed to implementing the will of the voters. And in fact, as of December 15th, of course, it's now legal to possess and to use and to home grow marijuana in limited quantities. What the next step in the process is to put in place a legal market in order to allow the sale and the purchase of marijuana. And that's a very complicated undertaking, and that's what we're committed to moving forward with next. So the legislation that I filed in the new session and that other senators and representatives have filed as well basically seeks to do three things. It seeks to fill in gaps which were not addressed by the ballot law. Second, it seeks to clarify areas in the ballot law that there's some confusion around. For example, we're hearing a lot from our municipal officials with a lot of questions. And third, it seeks to strengthen some areas in the ballot law where there are significant concerns that we're hearing from various stakeholders.
Okay, so I want to get into those things in more detail in just a moment. But forgive me if I sound a little thick-headed, but I don't understand how making wholesale changes to key aspects of what was written in question 4 equivalent to implementing the will of the voters.
So, I don't believe that's what we're doing with these bills. For example, one of the bills addresses the issue of drug driving and how are we going to deal with likely increases in people driving under the influence. Another bill deals with creating a research program and data collection. Another bill deals with the kinds of packaging and labeling requirements to ensure that these products are used safely.
But what about the ones that make very significant reductions to how much people can possess? Question 4 said a home limit of 10 ounces. One of the bills suggests reducing that to 2 ounces. And home growing, which was a major part of why some people supported question 4, the ballot question passed with 12 plants for home growing. There's a bill that proposes reducing that to 6. I mean, those are very specific reductions that I think people are kind of upset about.
So let me take those one by one. In terms of possession, we have to remember marijuana remains illegal under federal law to schedule one drug. And so even with legalization, there's many limits on what you can and can't do. And the most significant of those is that you can possess up to 1 ounce. And an ounce of marijuana is about equivalent to 50 joints. So it's not a very small amount. In this ballot question, there was language to allow up to 10 ounces at home. And frankly, I think that was reflecting what we have for the medical marijuana program. But recreational marijuana is not the same as medical marijuana. And in almost every other state, there's no allowance for possessing marijuana, additional amounts of marijuana in your own home. Yeah. So that changes to reflect what's generally true across the country and to reflect the fact that we want to allow people to possess, you know, reasonable quantities, but not more than that. I can also address the home growing separately if you'd like.
Okay, and I will let you do that. And I do promise that there are so many bills here under consideration that I will allow you to get to them, as many of them as possible. But you can see why I do want to ask you, possibly in different directions, but the same set of questions about why the legislature feels compelled to make these changes. Because we put this question out to listeners earlier about, you know, that you were going to be on the show. And you can imagine we got a lot of feedback. And I just want to read to you a subset, a sample of the kinds of questions we got back from folks. For example, the people voted to pass the cannabis referendum with specific details. Why do you feel compelled to undermine the will of the people? Why is Massachusetts trying to bypass the will of the voters regarding the specific provisions passed in question 4? Why do you feel it necessary to contravene the will of the majority of Massachusetts voters? Why not govern based on the will of your constituency? How does Mr. Lewis square his recent vote to raise his salary with his obstinate attitude towards question 4, which passed with a large majority? And if Jason Lewis works for the people, why does he approach this as if he works for himself? That's just a subset of the kind of questions we got.
Yeah, and I've certainly heard the same sort of feedback from my own constituents as well as others, and I understand and I listen very carefully to that. At the same time, I've also heard feedback from public health experts, from those who work in the addiction community and treat substance abuse, from mayors and municipal officials, from police officers and businesses, and others who are very concerned about exactly how the law is implemented and making sure that, yes, we absolutely have to move forward with legalization as quickly and as efficiently, as expeditiously as we can in terms of a legal market. But let's do that thoughtfully. Let's do that safely. Let's prioritize public health. And frankly, let's learn from what's happened in Colorado, Washington, and other states. And that's all that I'm seeking to do with the bills that I've filed.
So Colorado, as an example, why not just let legalization unfold as was written in question 4, let the market establish itself on the timeline that it was asked for in the question, and then over time make the changes that emerge as actually being necessary. It seems as if the legislature is doing the opposite. The legislature is saying, nope, we can exactly anticipate what the problems are going to be a year or two from now, so let's slow everything down at the moment. Whereas I think a lot of advocates and a lot of people who voted for question 4 say, no. Let the question or the law written in the question do what it's supposed to do and make the changes that we actually need when we need them.
Well, first of all, all of these bills that I filed, and I think there's 75 in total that have been filed in the new session, they're all going to get debated. Nothing is worked out yet. There'll be public hearings. I'm hoping they'll be all around the state so that it'll make it accessible and convenient for people to attend and to weigh in.
You can understand why there's some doubt about that because of the delay that was passed in informal session.
Well, I can speak to that if you like as well. We would have preferred to have done that in a formal session when all the lawmakers were present, but we really needed to do that before the end of the year because otherwise we would have been actually implementing the law and building a whole regulatory structure at the same time that we were making changes to it. But to your, I think, very important question, which is why not wait? I don't subscribe to the school of thought that says let's let things happen. Let the problems occur when we know what's likely to happen when we look at other states. Colorado, for example, has passed more than 20 bills since their legalization was approved at the ballot.
And people would say the sky has not fallen Colorado.
No one's saying it's falling. That's not what I'm saying either. And I spent time in Colorado, but they've had a lot of challenges that they've had to deal with, and they've learned a lot of lessons along the way. And I think that it would behoove us to take advantage of all of that, and let's do this right in the first place. Why would we want to go forward knowing that we're going to have a whole series of problems? And frankly, why would we not want to focus on public health and prevention efforts? Why would we not want to do everything we can It's fine if adults want to make the decision to, you know, consume cannabis, but I think we want to do everything possible to keep it out of the hands of kids and teenagers and to not increase rates of use among our teens.
But Senator Lewis,
as well as keeping it off of our roads as well.
I really wonder, what could you say or what do you want to say to people listening to this who just say, look, we remember that you were very, you know, publicly on the record as being opposed to question four. You spoke eloquently. You made your case eloquently before the election. And now they just see these bills as attempts by the legislature to just slow things down, to muddy up the process to the point where, you know, the market itself ultimately will have difficulty getting established. You know, like there's a lot of businesses who are like, I will not be able to get the financing I need if there's so much uncertainty around where the market's gonna be able to get launched in Massachusetts.
Well, there is certainly a lot of uncertainty because this is a new market and we don't know what's going to happen in Washington and there's a lot of things to figure out. But the legislature is very committed to moving forward quickly. You know, we've just created a brand new marijuana committee. It's the first time that's ever existed. The reason for that is to put all of this in one place because there's public safety issues, public health issues, there's revenue issues, there's municipal issues, which ordinarily would be handled by a whole variety of different committees. We've decided to create one. That process is going to get underway, you know, over the next few months. And Governor Baker has said already he'd like to have a final bill on his desk by the spring. So that's the goal we're working towards,
By
the spring. And so we're not looking to create confusion or uncertainty any more than already exists or to slow down the market. But again, we really, I think, owe it to everybody in the state, not people who voted for this and people who didn't, that we do this right and we do it safely.
So I did promise you the chance to briefly sort of tell us about some of these proposed changes. We talked about the proposal to reduce the home limit. What about home growing? Why cut that from 12 plants to 6?
So I think that will be debated, and we should have a good discussion about that. Allowing up to 12 plants is actually a pretty considerable amount of marijuana. You can argue over that and how many strains that you can produce. But if you know what you're doing, that's a very significant amount of marijuana you can grow. That's more than is allowed in virtually any other state. Washington State doesn't allow any home growing, for that matter. Most states allow something closer to 6. And, you know, again, we see problems in Colorado with a very large black market. A lot of that is fed by home growing, which is not easy to enforce. And I think we want to get off, you know, in Massachusetts in the right place. And we want to allow people to home grow. I think they definitely voted for that. But I do think at the same time, we should put reasonable limits around that. But I think that will absolutely be debated as we go through the next few months.
One of the proposals is also to allow cities and towns to ban the sale of marijuana without a special election or local referendum. Mm-hmm. Why do that?
So I'll give you a good example of the kinds of concerns and confusion this is creating. So I just met with the city of Somerville just last week, and that's a city where they are rolling out medical marijuana now. They're going to be having, I think, up to 4 dispensaries in the city, and, you know, the residents of Somerville strongly support that. And they fully expect that they will have recreational marijuana facilities in the city as well. Retail outlets, maybe grow facilities. Under the ballot question, where those medical marijuana facilities are located, they would be required to allow recreational in the same location. Well, some of those medical marijuana dispensaries, and by the way, they've gone through a year-long process to work this out, are located right near schools because they're treating them like pharmacies. Because it's medical marijuana. So they are very concerned that they would be forced to allow a retail pot shop potentially to be also in a very close vicinity to a school. And that's the kind of thing that they want to have control over. And so the changes that are proposed in that particular bill I filed would basically just give our cities and towns more control over exactly what they want to do in moving forward with recreational marijuana. And I'm hearing loud and clear from municipal officials that that's the way they'd like to move forward.
And briefly, in just a couple seconds, there's also a proposal to allow people arrested in connection with 1 ounce of possession of marijuana to possibly expunge that arrest from their records.
Yes, and that's because, like many activists who push for the ballot question, I'm concerned about the social justice aspects of this. I'm concerned about the war on drugs that we've been fighting for decades, and how many people have been harmed by that, and how many families have been hurt by that. And so, what I'm proposing in this legislation is that you could essentially expunge your record if you have a conviction for possession of up to an ounce, which is what's now legal. So if you've basically were arrested and convicted for something that now is legal, that you should be able to have that expunged from your criminal, from your record. So there'll be some debate over that as well. That's an example of something that law enforcement, I think, will, you know, may push back on.
Right. But well, I hope there's vigorous, what you said is what comes to pass, that there's vigorous public debate about each and every one of these proposals. I mean, just, we have a couple seconds left to go. Senator Lewis, I just have to return to this one question. I know that legislators don't love voter referenda. Many of them have come on this show to say they feel it's a blunt instrument. But on the other hand, sometimes democracy is a blunt instrument, and people are thinking that you and your fellow legislators are acting in an undemocratic way. Are you?
As I said, I don't believe we are. We're trying to implement this law in a way that is thoughtful, that's careful, that emphasizes public health, and that where we learn from other states and the issues that they've run into along the way. And I think ultimately this will be better for marijuana users, for marijuana businesses, and the public at large if we do this right.
Well, Senator Jason Lewis is a Democratic state senator, and he's co-sponsoring these 15 bills that are pending on Beacon Hill. I always am very grateful that you come and talk with us, Senator Lewis. We look forward to keeping up this conversation as the session progresses.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.